I've decided to begin tonight's discussion about children's literature by relating some things I've heard children themselves say recently. That wasn't planned. Here is an exchange between a three-year-old boy and a four-year-old girl. "I really love you, Naomi. Do you love me?" "Yes," says Naomi. "Are you going to marry me?" A preschooler made the following observation when asked what his parents did. "My father works, my mother stays at home and drinks coffee." Other preschoolers were heard saying that girls can't play with boats and that women can't play tennis. A four-year-old boy told his mother, "Women are stupid." When she asked him if she and other women he knew were stupid, he replied, "No, you are student women." When the same four-year-old girl, who is large for her age, and three-year-old boy that I mentioned before were fighting, the girl repeatedly whined, "I'm only a girl." She would also say when they were playing hockey, "It's hard for me, you know." Here's another example. In a park one day this summer, I watched in fascination as two 12-year-old girls verbally attacked a boy of about the same age in front of a group of children. They pointed out again and again how much like a girl he was. In fact, he looked to me no more feminine than any other prepubescent boy. They remarked on his lovely blonde hair, his big blue eyes, his long eyelashes, and his full red lips. They mimicked the way he moved and said he swayed his hips like a girl and even put a towel around his shoulders like a girl. When the boy finally despaired of being able to save face and left, the girls continued their tirade, insisting that anyone looking as feminine as that boy must be despicable. In another vein, here is a poem by a six-year-old Japanese girl called Father. "When my father wants to read the paper, he says, 'Paper, walk to me.' When he wants to smoke, he says, 'Cigarettes, walk to me.' Then my mother stands up to bring them to him." And finally, here's part of an interview with a five-year-old girl named Amy that I found in a textbook on personality. The interviewer asked, "How are girls and boys different? Boys have penises and girls have vaginas. How else? Boys make money to buy food. Girls want their children not to make too much noise. Boys work, sometimes help the mother, sometimes play with their children. Mothers, they try not to scream. Boys can grow up to be gardeners, and girls want their children to be very, very quiet and good." I find what these children say very distressing, primarily because most of them are so young. They're just preschoolers. Already, they have acquired biases and inhibiting ideas. Why, we must ask, should a four-year-old girl who almost doubles the weight of a three-year-old boy assume that she cannot meet him on at least equal terms in a game or in a fight? Why should a three-year-old girl not be able to play with a boat or look forward to playing tennis? What is happening when the most odious epithet two girls can think of is "pretty girl"? It reminds me very much of the tactics of oppressed people, the blacks, for example. At times, when a black man wanted to be extremely cutting, wanted to deliver the supreme put-down, he would address his fellow black as "nigger." And what can one say about the five-year-old girl, Amy? She sees no other possibility for women but motherhood and does not question it, despite the insight her statement reveals when she says, "Mothers, they try not to scream." I'm not citing these examples so that I can proceed to prove how children develop such ideas from the books they read or the television shows they watch. Children, as well as adults, are influenced by everything they experience. I cannot prove any direct relationship between what a child thinks and what she reads. I don't have to. It is enough to show that in this society, children develop unrealistic and limiting ideas of men and women, and what they read does virtually nothing to enlighten them. When a mother brings home the first book, picture book, for her one-year-old or her two-year-old, she is introducing her to a potentially extensive learning experience. At a basic level, books stimulate the child's senses. They reinforce what the child is already familiar with. They also present new material and knowledge to be digested. In addition to this, if the mother is selective and discriminating, books may give her child the opportunity to go beyond, at least intellectually, the patterns, people, the values and traditions of the immediate society in which she lives, to see other possibilities and accept them as non-threatening, to see the ways of life in different cultures, classes, and social groups presented sympathetically. It sounds exciting. For the young girl, however, the range of experience that books offer, especially for her, is not only limited, but often downright offensive. To begin with, just consider how frequently female characters are represented in picture books. In a review for the New York Times, Elizabeth Fisher noted that in picture books, females are represented only 20 to 30% of the time. There were 5 times as many males as females in the titles, and 4 times as many boys, men, or male animals pictured as there were females. Looking at the books recommended by local libraries, one reaches the same conclusion. Male figures outnumber females at least 3 to 1. In a parent's guide to children's reading, of 620 books listed, 235 had male central characters and 82 had female characters. The remainder were either both or miscellaneous. Even the animals in books are mostly males. The stories of Curious George, Peter Rabbit, Baba the Elephant, and the books of Maurice Sendak and Dr. Seuss, for example, are populated almost entirely by males. Fisher observes that in the Veld, it is a female lion who does all the work. In the picture world, she does not exist. It is interesting also to look at the animals that are pictured as females. There is Petunia the goose, Francis the badger, and Sylvia the sloth. The rhinoceros is a male, the hippopotamus is a female. Even the seemingly harmless animal book reflects the low opinion of women in this society. They are the geese, the badgers, and the sloths, animals customarily associated with derogation. If little girls are eager for female models or ideals, not only will they have a hard time finding them in picture books, they will also find little that is challenging in what they do encounter. In a veritable compendium of basic information for social neophytes called The Best Word Book Ever by Richard Scarry, children see smiling little animals doing all the things that people do. They work with tools, they drive trucks, cars, and boats. That is, all the animals in pants do. When they play with toys, the girls are content with a tea set and a doll, while the boys monopolize all the other toys, from the bow and arrow to the building set and the train. There's a page in this book called When You Grow Up, which, despite the promising opening question, would you like to be a good cook like your father, allots occupations pretty much as one might fear. The doctor, pilot, carpenter, fireman, and artist are males. The secretary, nurse, teacher, librarian, and mother of 10 are females. The page devoted to things we do shows males doing just about everything, while the females are confined to three cameo appearances: sitting, watching, and whispering. Generally, little girls in picture books are passive and subdued. They walk, read, and dream, but they do not climb on fences or ride bicycles. They have emotions, they get angry, they disagree, they smile, they want to please, but they do not act. Boys do, and girls are. In a simple book by Janice Udry called A Tree is Nice, boys balance in trees, go fishing, roll in leaves, and hang from ropes, while the girls, who are definitely in the minority, are seen watching, leading small children, and helping little boys. In another book, CDB, by William Steig, girls again are seen as helpers, and although here they are somewhat more active and adventuresome, they don't quite make it. A boy is shown on skates while a girl has fallen down. A girl turns a somersault, but she becomes dizzy. And that old favorite of Robert Louis Stevenson, A Child's Garden of Verse, would be more accurately titled A Boy's Garden of Verse, for the only females in his garden are mothers and aunties. A little girl would not be misreading if she concluded that it seems that boys do most of the interesting and most of the recognized childhood activities in books. Girls, on the other hand, are encouraged to forgo the accepted childhood abandon and zest, to be quiet and demure, to cultivate the charms and wiles that will later catch them a good husband. There is a song sung on the children's program Sesame Street which makes this difference fairly clear. It is about what girls and boys do. Girls help mother cook and sew, play with dolls, wear bows in their hair, and they can be beautiful. Boys run and jump and never fall, throw a ball, grow 6 feet tall, make mud pies, and get covered with mess. When you watch television, you can see that big business, too, is attempting to cash in on the premature puberty being forced on girls. In a commercial for Avon's Small World products, there are girls no older than 10 trying out Avon's Almost cosmetics. Phony lipsticks, perfumes, powders, and sprays of all sorts. Girls, we are led to believe, are little mothers, housewives, and part-time vamps. As such, however, their identity derives entirely from some actual or some future relationship with a male. There is one book called Whom Shall I Marry? That Sarah Spinks reproduced in an article on the socialization of girl children, which makes this obvious. It reads, Primrose was playing house. Just as she finished pouring tea for her dolls, she began to think. She thought and thought, and she thought some more. Whom shall I marry? Whomever shall I marry? I think I shall marry a mailman. Then I could go to everybody's house and give them their mail. Or I might marry a policeman. I could help him take the children across the street. But if I marry a fireman, it will be exciting. I'll ring the bell real loud, and everybody will get out of the way. Maybe, though, I ought to marry a doctor. I would be his nurse, and we would help people be strong and healthy. Or perhaps a man who owns a bookstore. Then I could find the most wonderful books for my friends to read. A gardener is somebody I'd like to marry. I could help him plant flowers, the big ones and the tiny ones, and everybody would smell so sweet. And suppose I marry a boat captain. I would steer the boat, and we would sail right over the biggest waves. Oh, but wouldn't I like to marry a farmer? We'd have ducks and chickens and cherries and peaches and a cow and a horse and a tiny squealing pig. Or a zookeeper. He would feed the big animals, but I would feed the baby ones. Say, wouldn't it be fun to marry the merry-go-round man, or the balloon man, or a clown? But now that I think it over, maybe I'll just marry somebody I love. The only way Primrose can conceive of doing the things she wants to in life is by marrying a man who does them. But the real blow comes when she decides that a girl superseding all good things like flowers and boats and animals is love. Somehow, love and marriage can replace all the things she would like to do in life. Poor Primrose. That is an illusion that has haunted women for years, an illusion that has created many disgruntled, discontented, and neurotic housewives. For women have internalized the standards of femininity that have been unquestioningly lauded for centuries. As a result, they are often as guilty, if not more so, as men of male chauvinism. In Women, a Journal of Liberation, Leah Hay notes that many of the writers of children's books are women with families who, in addition to their domestic roles, must also take their roles as writer or artist seriously. Yet their feminine characters are overwhelmingly portrayed in domestic and maternal roles. Picture books typically present a contemporary middle-class view of the world. Fantasy, fairy tales, and folk tales, dating back many years, present men and women in a different, but no less rigidly defined way. Since the range of experience in this type of literature is so vast, I will concentrate on the world of kings and queens, princes and princesses, witches and fair maidens. After reading many fairy tales, I found that there were two separate patterns, although both had several common characteristics. One trend is exemplified by such stories as Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, Snow White, Tattercoats, and One Eye, Two Eyes, Three Eyes. In all these tales, the main female character is of unmatched beauty and impeccable virtue. Because of these qualities, she is singled out for a special fate: discovery by some high-placed male and marriage to him. Until that time, though, the heroine's beauty and goodness bring her no comfort on earth. In fact, she incurs the hate and jealousy of all women around her, who are usually as ugly and vile as she is lovely. They mistreat her and frequently isolate her from the rest, or at least the best, of society. Cinderella's stepmother and sisters relegate her to a straw bed in a garret. Snow White finds herself exiled to a dark, threatening forest by her stepmother. And Two Eyes is hidden in a barrel by her mother and her one-eyed and three-eyed sisters. Men in these stories are never the misogynists. Only women are the enemies of the heroine. The concept of community and friendship among women is completely lacking, and this is carried to such an extreme that even mothers are seen as vicious tormentors of their daughters. The story One Eye, Two Eyes, Three Eyes that I've already mentioned is one example. More frequently, however, the agent of evil is a stepmother. For a young child, though, perhaps the distinction between a natural mother and a stepmother is not too clear. In actuality, there may be no distinction. The majority of fairy tales I read thus encourage girls to distrust all women, and mothers in particular. To get back to the first type of fairy tale that I was describing, though, the fate of the average heroine appears to be passive suffering followed by a sudden rise to a favored position by virtue of her intrinsic worth, that is, a sensational body. The other pattern I noticed is basically the same as the first, with the exception that the female plays a more active part. The heroines of this second type of tale are beautiful and good too, but they are also bold and daring, and prove themselves fearless of bulls, beasts, bears, witches, and the raging elements. The inspiration for their trials, their quests, and adventures is some prince who has been bewitched by an evil woman, more often than not a stepmother. His return to a normal life is dependent upon the girl's proof of love. For example, Beauty, in Beauty and the Beast, goes off to live with a monster in order to save her father, and eventually she saves the beast, who is actually a bewitched prince, too. In another story, East of the Sun and West of the Moon, a young girl leaves home with a white bear so that her family may gain riches. Then she endures 7 years and 7 days of hardship in order to save the bear, who is, of course, also a prince. And so it goes on. Goodness and virtue in fairy tale women boil down to a tremendous capacity for self-sacrifice and martyrdom. The message is simple. The woman who is able to completely give up all thought of her own welfare and even face possible death for a man is truly feminine. She may accomplish this either by suffering quietly or by some brand of active self-flagellation. In spite of the extreme selflessness of such heroines, some of them still impress one as strong, courageous, and quite admirable. The end result of their long struggles, nonetheless, is to become an idle ornament. Remember the nursery rhyme, curly locks, wilt thou be mine? Thou shalt not wash dishes, nor yet feed the swine. Thou shalt sit on a cushion and sow a fine seed, and feed upon strawberries, sugar, and cream. This is the reward that is theirs when they finally save the prince. They disappear into a castle, close the heavy doors against adventure, and sit on a cushion so as not to bruise their delicate bottoms for the rest of their lives. We have a modern parallel to these latter-day heroines, I think. She is called the student wife. She pits herself against the cold reality of the working world so that her poor prince may someday become a productive member of society, and she may retire from that society and never have to work or do much of anything that is demanding again. Except, today, more of our heroines are deciding they want to stay in the world where adventures of a sort happen, that they enjoy facing a challenge too. The books and stories I've talked about until now come to the Canadian child from a variety of other countries, but are nevertheless an established and prominent part of Canadian reading. Books actually written and published in Canada by Canadians reveal more explicitly, though, what is happening in Canada and how Canadians see themselves. The first Canadian books were influenced considerably by the English books of the time, in style that is. The content of the books was dominated completely by the Canadian scene, adjustment to a new land, discovery of its beauty and bounty, as well as its severity and impartiality. As children's books in England evolved from didacticism to fantasy, Canadian writers remained staunchly committed to the pioneer experience. And unfortunately, this seems to be the case today. Canadians are still cranking out variations on the themes of exploration, fur trading, fighting the wilderness, endurance, and survival. Most of the recent books, understandably enough, lack the immediacy of those written in the 19th century. Our modern books have been described as antiseptic in quality. They lack the strong emotions, harsh realities, and often the simple facts that those older writers knew of firsthand. In other countries, the emphasis in children's literature has been continually changing. With the 1960s came a radical switch from a calm, idyllic view of childhood to an emphasis on psychological and social problems, particularly in the United States. Children began to be seen coping with difficult parents, growing up, drugs, racism, homosexuality, and feelings of loneliness and isolation. Children in Canada, however, were still lost in the barrens, visiting a lighthouse, training a dog, or outwitting horse thieves. Here are a few of the titles of Canadian books reviewed in 1971 by a library periodical. French Explorers of North America, The Fur Fort, The Art of Angling, Wonders of the World of Wolves, Rural Ontario, The Pacific Coast, Tales of a Pioneer Surveyor, Colonists at Point Royal, The Hudson's Bay Company, Canada on Wheels, Once There Was a Camper, and The Broken Snare. The significance of all this for Canada's female population is this. Like the lioness in the veld, they do not exist in books. For the adventures in the wilderness all happen to little boys. It may well be that in the past, girls have not generally been found alone in the woods with a Cree boy on a hunting trip or riding as outrider in a chuck wagon race. But certainly they were in Canada, and they no doubt had adventures and interesting experiences too. Also, there are stories of a more bland nature which could just as well have a girl for the main character as a boy. The emphasis is simply on child. Yet almost invariably, a boy gets the part. There begins to appear an insidious pattern, if not deliberate design, in all this, especially when one considers the nature of the stories in which girls do appear. To find such books, one has to go to the Canadian school system. There, in textbooks, readers, and suggested novels and stories, we may find females, grossly outnumbered as usual. Most of what I have to say regarding school books can be found in a report written by WIT, a Vancouver group of teachers. They analyzed books up to the grade 7 level. I will be concentrating on the general trends they found and their conclusions. If anyone wants to see the actual statistics behind my generalizations, they can look at the report themselves. Readers for the first two grades concentrate on the family and family activities, what a mother is and does, and what a father is and does. Mother stays at home and involves herself only in household activities. She is nurturant and always available if the children need her, unless, of course, they want her to play with them. For mothers have priorities, you understand, and anything smacking of fun must take back seat to hard work and drudgery. No, mother usually has more important cleaning and cooking to do when she is asked to join the children's play. As one might expect, discipline and punishment are the mother's domain also. Father, on the other hand, is almost always seen playing games with the children or taking them on outings. He takes them tobogganing, picnicking, and skating. Mother stays at home during these expeditions. His relationship with all his children is not exactly equal, however. The bond between father and son is special. There are some activities that are reserved for them alone, like fishing. Then they leave all females, mothers, wives, and sisters behind. This image of the father has been foisted on us by Dr. Spock and other so-called child-rearing experts in the past 30 years or so. They emphasized paternal participation in the child's socialization. But somehow, this was not conceived in terms of, nor did it take the form of, diaper washing, toilet training, or discipline. Instead, fathers became weekend pals or bantam baseball coaches. Sesame Street again exaggerates the dichotomy of sex roles to an almost absurd degree. Gordon and Susan are a married couple living on Sesame Street. Susan is cheerful and almost always seen bustling busily about her kitchen, making things for Gordon, carrying out the trash, going to the store, and addressing all and sundry as dear. In contrast, Gordon does not appear to have a job. Rather, he is usually seen sitting in a chair or on the steps, reading a newspaper, talking with children, telling them stories, and demonstrating new concepts. Although Susan appears to do most of the work, the power distribution in their relationship was made clear in one episode I happened to see. Manhattan headlines declaimed a shortage of nurses, which Susan uneasily brought to Gordon's attention with the nervous suggestion that she could perhaps return to the work in which she was trained, practical nursing, just to help out. Gordon, after a few probing questions, finally himself suggested she could return to work with his approval. When Susan hurries off to unpack her uniform, Gordon comments that it pleases him very much to be able to make her happy. It's interesting to note, by the way, that the BBC has banned Sesame Street, citing as one of its reasons the stress put on middle-class values. If nothing else, the persistent association of women exclusively with motherhood and housework is unrealistic, for women constitute one-third of the labor force in Canada. There is one book published in the United States, however, which challenges the outdated image of women. It is called Mummies Who Work by Eve Merriam and shows women doing everything from carpentry to atom splitting while still managing to have children and a home life. In discussing the remainder of the school books, I will concentrate on the differences in behavior between males and females. As a rule, boys are shown as independent, courageous, resourceful, rational, and mischievous, while girls are dependent, emotional, irrational, and obedient. Girls must be rescued, supported in some way, or taught a lesson. Let's look at some of the stories. In The Grizzly, a boy, David, advises his father, "If girls get jittery about bears and stuff, you've just got to be kind. Don't get mad at them for being nervous. That's why they need men around all the time." An 18-year-old boy in Word to Caesar comments on a girl who obtained valuable information from him. "She seems so intelligent, more like a boy." The female who is seen as capable or intelligent is either an anomaly or a fraud. In Jake Was a Tomboy, Jacqueline goes fishing with the boys but insults them by being more adept. In a burling contest, she is nearly drowned, but the boys manage to save her, and she decides to repent and change her ways. "Don't call me